Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire service. This week, we'll be discussing legislation on Governor Inslee's desk that could make gas in homes a relic of the past. A former state worker suing over retaliation for refusal to lie about how much the carbon auction would affect gas prices. Legislation requiring unlimited access of county elections offices to a group that helps suppress what they called social media misinformation, and a growing list of state lawmakers heading for the exits. That's ahead on Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Some people would call him a loser. He ran for state office. He was beaten. He started a business. He failed. He ran for Congress. He lost. He was nominated for vice president. He lost again. But he knew only those who never tried are the real losers. And Abraham Lincoln was no loser. Persistence. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now, let's jump into the headlines. Passed in the middle of the night, controversial legislation that would allow the state's utilities to reduce the number of homes it supplies natural gas to. Capitol reporter Carlene Johnson covered this story. First off, Carlene, give listeners an idea of what this bill enables.
Well, 1589, the bill number allows PSE to increase energy bills, basically for customers to pay for upgrades that are aimed at ultimately phasing out natural gas service. So what it does is it requires PSE to plan to meet the statutory decarbonization requirements that are already in state law. And so proponents argue that, you know, if we don't have this bill that, you know, is requiring PSE to do certain things, they would continue planning, you know, to be reliant on fossil fuels indefinitely. And they say that the Utilities and Transportation Commission will still have oversight ultimately, but UTC has already said on the record, they're going to do what they're advised to do. And so GOP members are telling the Center Square that, you know, UTC at this point simply rubber stamps anything that Governor Inslee wants on his climate agenda. And this is a big piece of it. Many, many Republicans I spoke to in person in Olympia this week say this is the most devastating piece of legislation that came out of this session.
In terms of like a so what for the homeowners and potential new homeowners in Washington, what would this bill becoming law mean? Is it just a simple, I want to build a new home and I'm never going to be able to get a gas line to it? Or is it, does it even go so far as to say, I own a home? I've owned my home in rural Washington for years and I've heated it with gas. And now right. I could get a notice from PSE saying, sorry, we're going to make you switch over.
And that's some of the ambiguity that has, opponents really concerned, because the language in the legislation includes things like phasing out certain parts that you might need to upgrade. You know, I have natural gas in my own home. Say they phase out a certain piece that I need to upgrade, you know, the equipment that I have in my home. That's no longer allowed in the state of Washington. But you also can't get it into the state of Washington. There are so many ambiguities left in the legislation that basically, you know, if the goal here, which it seems, is to meet the statutory decarbonization requirements, you know, making us carbon neutral by 2050, it's kind of a moving target at this point. But they have so much power now to say, in the name of this legislation, we must do this. And they also attached an emergency clause. And that means, despite the fact that litigation is inevitable because of multiple constitutional issues in this legislation, it's going to go into effect, which then means PSE is going to go, okay, we need to proactively increase rates, even if this thing ends up ultimately being tossed out.
Now, during the process, I know state legislators across the country all have a different way of going about this, but there's always this one step where the experts in their, you know, their caucuses or the legal experts will look at a bill and say, here are the potential constitutional or legal worries from federal manner to give a proper warning as to the legality of the proposed legislation. Did lawmakers ever get any opinions as to the legal political muster of potentially making homeowners switch from gas to electric?
Well, we got some shocking comments late last week from the president of the Senate, Lieutenant Governor Denny Heck, who basically came out and said, as we recovered on the center, as we covered on the center square, that the bill's a hot mess, that there were so many constitutional issues, oversteps that were contradictory to already what is in state statute. He basically said, throw this thing out and start over. And you had both parties saying, I think he just stuck a fork in this thing. But it was resurrected over the weekend. And by the time, you know, Monday came to a conclusion, you had 4 to 6 Democrats that were needed ultimately in the House to get this thing passed into law. Those 4 to 6 Democrats were holdouts, but the House operates different than the Senate. And at that point, the Speaker of the House, Lori Jenkins, is able to look at the final roll call and go, we're a couple short. But instead of closing out the final vote as they operate in the Senate, those are the rules of the Senate, the House can simply say, time out. And one by one, those members get called into her office. And I am of the understanding, and the governor's office did not deny it, that at that point, the governor, this is 1, 2 a.m., is on the phone with individual members saying, you're going to pass this thing, and here's why. Some of the Republicans told me that it was to say, your pet piece of legislation ain't going to get signed into law if you don't sign on to 1589. Now, the response from the governor's office today was to say, you know, this is absurd. Negotiations, compromises take place every day. These characterizations are sour grapes. And I haven't heard of anyone claiming they were mistreated. That was the quote from the governor's office I got in response today. It's a done deal now, but legislation, or I should say litigation, is coming. In the meantime, consumers can look for their PSE bills to go way up.
Right. And beyond just the PSE bill going up, which is seems like an inevitability at this point, you mentioned the conversion. That sounds expensive. Because, I mean, in a previous life, I worked in, you know, worked with a lot of building contractors. That sounds like something to retroactively change a house out from gas to electric that might be prohibitively expensive. Have they given any estimates on to how much? If PSC comes to someone's home and says, listen, you've got to switch out to electric, and you've got until this time to do it because we're going to cut your gas off at this point. Has there been any estimations as to how much a homeowner would have to shell out because of this edict?
Well, according to the Building Industry Association of Washington, who, you know, testified in strong objection to this, you know, anybody who owns a home that heats with natural gas required to convert to electricity under this bill at an average cost, if I was forced to convert today, it's about $40,000, according to the BIAW. And that's on top of having to pay monthly rates that are also predicted to double under this bill in the coming years. And again, let's remember, that's whether you own a home or rent. Renters might think, oh, this is not going to affect me directly. Well, you don't think that that landlord, that property owner is going to pass that cost on to you? Of course they are. Of course
they
are.
That's a great point. Yeah. And that's something we've always seen is when it comes to, you know, regulations and property taxes. Even you look at, well, I'm a renter. I don't pay property taxes. Well, you do. it's all baked into your rent, you know, in terms of all of that, all of those initial costs, because the landlord is just not going to suddenly take a loss because this cost came up. So yeah, it sounds like you're going to go from being a Capitol reporter to a judicial reporter later this summer, to follow all this. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Carlene. Appreciate it. We'll, keep an eye on this one and update you as it happens. But next up, lawmakers in Olympia are ushering through legislation that would put some requirements on county elections offices. That's got some interesting strings attached. Investigative reporter TJ Martinell dug into this bill. TJ, give listeners a broad view of what this legislation would do.
Effectively, what it does, a couple of things. One, it gives the Secretary of State the authority to certify an election if the county won't do it without cause. And it requires more reporting for any kind of cybersecurity attacks on the county election systems. But the big one is that it requires that they all use the exact same type of basically cybersecurity protection known as an intrusion detection system. And what this does is it passively monitors the system and is designed to detect intruders or malicious activity and alert the people, whoever's handling the system, alert them to what's going on.
And now, you know, you look at this, it's in the context of reality. Most of the state's elections offices and nationally, I mean, counties across the country, bipartisan, already use this system. What's the situation in Washington where they're going to mandate this? What's the need for that?
Well, there's three. One argument by a county is that they're being strong-armed into doing this because there's three counties that currently do not use it. There was one county in particular that was using it, and they stopped using it because, according to them, they had a cybersecurity attack, and the nonprofit that manages the program didn't notify them. And so their other problem that they have is that this is a program that they're being forced to use. They don't have any other – they're not – under the law, they're not given other options for what kind of program that they want to use. They have to use the intrusion detection system that's prescribed by the Secretary of State's office.
Why? I don't understand why they would be forced to use just one company's system. I mean, was that brought up in debate?
That wasn't, the proponents didn't really say anything, but that's, there was the amendments that were proposed that would have allowed them to use the different options, and it was struck down. There was a lot of very interesting amendments that were not adopted, but they were proposed on the on I believe the House floor.
It's interesting that, you know, local offices, these county elections offices, have to have this machine in and installed and operating, but they can't see anything that it's doing. They can't see what it's looking at, and they're not and this company is apparently not required to tell them at all. I don't understand why there's no need for communication there when, you know, the ones responsible should be the county office, correct?
Well, here's the other part is, so the counties are being forced to use this program. There was a proposed amendment that would have made the company liable for attacks where they were responsible for it. And that amendment was struck down or rejected. There was another amendment that would have made the state liable since they're being forced, the counties are being forced to use a product that they don't want to necessarily use. That would have made the state liable, and that amendment was also rejected. So the county is still liable for whatever happens, even though they're being forced to use a intrusion detection system by an organization that's not liable at the direction of the Secretary of State's office, which is also not liable.
And they're called Albert machines. Who manages these little boxes?
They're managed by the nonprofit, the Center for Internet Security, which is based out of New York State.
That name has come up before, and that they've actually found themselves in some controversy back in during the COVID pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, and election cycles thereafter.
What they've been found doing is collaborating with government officials to get social media posts deemed disinformation removed. So what they would do is the government officials would contact CIS about election or voting or COVID misinformation, and then CIS would report it to the social media platform in question.
At the federal level, a judge issued a scathing ruling likening that process that included CIS, the one that is managing these Albert boxes. He called it the akin to the Orwellian Ministry of Truth, which is eye-popping to say the least. And these ones are this is the same nonprofit that's going to be managing these unfettered Albert boxes in terms of being able to see what's going on in election officials' offices and computers and such. So fascinating stuff, TJ. I will be interested to see what else comes out of this as we continue to dig down. Thank you. On to the judiciary we go, where a former state worker is suing multiple agencies for what he claims is retaliation for what he calls sixth grade math. State editor Brett Davis covered this announcement. Brett, what was the initial clash between this state worker and his employer?
So former Washington State Department of Transportation economist Scott Smith, he provided more details at a Wednesday press conference along with his lawyer, Jackson Maynard of the Citizen Action Defense Fund. Smith alleges he faced hostility and retaliation after he refused to keep quiet about his calculations last year that showed Washington's cap and trade program would increase gas prices by anywhere from 45 to 50 cents per gallon. He said the hostility and retaliation came in the form of things like being refused basic software upgrades, being denied time off to visit his elderly mother, all the way up to having his job eliminated through House Bill 1838, which was passed by the legislature last year. That bill moves transportation revenue forecasting to the Economic and Revenue Forecast Council. Smith went on to say he couldn't take the pressure anymore, and he quit in early November. The term used in the lawsuit is constructively discharged. The situation came to light late last year, and on Tuesday, the CADF, they filed a lawsuit in Thurston County Superior Court against WASDOT, the Office of Financial Management, and the governor's office.
Leading up to this, there was it seemed like he's describing a alleged pressure campaign to say, you know, I get that your math says this, but can it not say that? Because that's a really inconvenient equation.
That's correct.
And in the end, he was proven right.
Right. His calculations proved to be pretty accurate. At the press conference, you know, he basically said his estimates were, as you hinted at earlier, a matter of sixth grade math. You reiterated that if you make it more expensive to produce a good or a service, the cost to customers goes up. So he seemed surprised that this was a controversy at all.
And what's fascinating about Smith is that he supports the carbon tax.
That's right. I didn't know that until the press conference the other day. He made it very clear at the news conference that he thinks cap and trade is an effective way to reduce carbon emissions because it increases fuel costs and thereby it reduces demand. You know, that's what it's supposed to do. He said this isn't controversial in other states with similar policies like California.
Yeah, I mean, California, Quebec, who we've reported on right before, they have a joint auction, although their units, their credits are selling for, I believe, what was it the last time we checked? It was like 40% of a total of one credit that's selling in Washington, hence the severity of the gas price increase in Washington. That blew my mind when he said that. I was shocked because even though
you and me both,
he does agree with it, he said, absolutely not. I'm not willing to just, you know, this is my job. This is my credibility. I'm not willing to lie.
Right.
Just for what appeared to be, as he says, political expediency. Good mathematician, but terrible politician, I suppose.
Right.
So since Smith was, I guess he wasn't fired, he was kind of voluntired, I would say. He's had a pretty rough go.
Yeah, he said it's taken a real toll on him. He said he's been staying with relatives in the aftermath of all this and noted that he's 64 years old and he's applied for numerous other jobs and he hasn't gotten a single callback. He went on to describe himself as mentally, physically, and emotionally exhausted from this ordeal.
Now, what's he seeking in terms of a remedy? Is it monetary? Is he want his old job back?
It is. The lawsuit is seeking damages for loss of income and pension, loss of reputation, as well as punitive damages. No actual, you know, monetary figures were discussed, but that's what he's after.
And the pension is a big deal, too, because with for people, you know, that might not understand how pensions work, you have to vest years into getting a state, a public pension. And if you move jobs, you lose all of that money unless it's portable because you're staying within that same maybe, you know, unit of government or such. And if he did lose that, that represents a considerable amount of money because that guarantees you a certain portion of that, those contributions matched by state contributions, weird equations and such until you die. And if he did indeed lose his pension because of this, even though he quit, that could be a sizable settlement. So we'll definitely keep track of this. Thank you, Brett. And this is a fascinating story. Now, lawmakers in Washington, D.C., including Eastern Washington Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rodgers, are leaving office in growing numbers. We're also seeing a bit of an exodus of state lawmakers locally. Eastern Washington reporter Randy Brock has been tracking this trend. Randy, who is the latest Washington lawmaker to announce they're heading for the exit?
The latest departure came on Wednesday when Republican Senator Linda Wilson of Vancouver said she did not intend to seek re-election after 10 years in the legislature. And that includes 2 years in the House of Representatives, 2 4-year terms in the Senate. So today is the final day of the 2024 session, and about 150 or so lawmakers in both houses are going to be clearing off their desks in the near future, and a handful of them don't have plans to come back next year.
Along with Senator Wilson, who says he's also not returning to Olympia, right?
This week, there's also been announcements by two senior Democrats, Speaker pro tempore Karen Kaiser of Des Moines and Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig of Spokane. Kaiser's the Senate senior member. She's been in the legislature for 29 years. And in the House, two longtime Republican representatives, Joel Kretz, who lives in the small Okanagan County Burg of Wakanda, and J.T. Wilcox of Yelm, which is near Olympia, also say they don't plan to seek re-election.
how much experience is being lost here in terms of re-election years?
Well, Karen Kaiser, like I said, she's put in 29 years. Kretz was elected in 2005, so he's coming up on 20 years. Billig and Wilcox, they each have 14 years in the legislature. Wilson, she adds a decade's worth. So if my calculator is correct, that's about 87 years of institutional knowledge. That's a lot.
Now, why are these guys leaving? They're not seeking re-election. We've seen, and there's always a churn in state legislatures. Right. There always seems to be one, even if there's not a set of term limits for lawmakers, which even in those states, you can get around that by jumping from one chamber to the other. And it's this odd little dance that they do to maintain their status as career politicians. But we've seen a pretty big exodus pending out of Congress this year. What about Olympia?
Linda Wilson said she wants to get back to being a grandmother to her six grandkids, involved again in her family business. She's a pretty staunch conservative, but, you know, once she gets out there, she also indicates she wants to raise awareness about three voter initiatives that are going to be on the ballot later this year. And that's to repeal the state's capital gains tax, the Climate Commitment Act, and the long-term care program. Politically speaking, I would anticipate that Karen Kaiser, a Democrat, might be opposed to those efforts. Even at age 76, she says she's not done and will keep going full tilt until it's time to hand off to someone else. In regards to Andy Billig, he's the CEO of Brett Sports. They operate two professional minor league professional sports franchises, the Spokane Chiefs hockey team and the Spokane Indians baseball team. So that's a full-time gig for him right there. Kretz and Wilcox, they've been a couple staunch conservatives during their time in the House, but they seem like they, you know, they want to indicate it's just time to move on. Kretz, who raises horses and cattle, he's literally looking at other pastures, I suspect.
How does this shake up the political landscape in Washington?
Well, I think for the Democrats, losing your backup Senate speaker and the majority leader in Kaiser and Billig, that seems like a pretty big deal. But the Democrats are probably going to keep control of the legislature in the near future, so I suspect there'll be some ready replacements. Republicans remain the minority party, but I'd expect any successors to Kretz and Wilcox will likely be Republicans. Their respective constituencies are largely conservative, especially Kretz. He's in the 7th District in Northeast Washington. That's probably the most conservative region in the state. Kind of a status quo, I suspect.
It's just pretty much next man up, as is common in state legislatures, right? It's just kind of becomes a revolving door, essentially. What I've noticed is that in Washington, it's something of an uncommon thing is for lawmakers to just not run for reelection. What you see in a lot of other states, and this is to Washington's credit. I like the fact that they're doing this, is that they are simply not running for reelection and letting the next lawmaker to be the person that wants that seat. Get it honestly. Don't be an appointed official. You see in a lot of other states where it's oftentimes that they will get elected, get reelected, and then 2 days after they win, they will announce their retirement, allowing the local party that's in power that's, you know, would be responsible for appointing that seat to appoint someone and give them the power of incumbency heading into the next political cycle, thus, you know, all but reassuring that they're the one that keeps that seat. It's a fascinating thing. And to Washington lawmakers' credits, I appreciate the fact that they're willing to let the process handle itself and let voters have their say. Randy, this is your last run with us. Wishing you a happy retirement and hopeful, safe rock climbing for you out in Central Washington here in the future.
Thank you very much. It's been a good experience. Thank you.
And a big thank you to the rest of our journalists for sharing their stories as well. Stay up to date with all these stories and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach, and until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.